Hi, this is Dave Pryor. Welcome to Leading Agile Sound Notes. So we've been doing podcasts with coaches and people who are out working in the field, trying to report back on the stuff that they're seeing when they work with our clients, and also, you know, different challenges they might encounter as well. Today, we've got something from a challenge I encountered. So I teach a lot of Scrum classes, and at the end of a class a few weeks ago in Atlanta, I had two guys ask questions, and for a number of different reasons, one of them probably being that it was the end of 2 days and my brain was like a piece of jelly, I asked them if I could record the questions, and I promised to get some of our coaches to join. So right now, I've got Adrian Weibel, who is brand new to Leading Agile, and Robert Sfair has been with Leading Agile for a while. You guys, thank you for spending some time to help us with these questions.
Pleasure.
My pleasure.
So do you guys want to each give a little bit of... Maybe, Robert, why don't you go first, a little bit of background about yourself, and then we'll get into questions real quick.
Sure. So my background is a software engineer, and I had been doing that for about 18 years. Started in the dot-com world, moved over to government contracting. From government contracting, I decided to get out of that and go back to a company called ThoughtWorks that really focused a lot on software development and product development. And then I decided that... transformation and trying to help teams was more my forte, and that's how I joined Leading Agile.
Cool. All right. And Adrian?
So I, too, grew up in the development world. I've got actually over 30 years of experience in software development. I put on my resume over 25 because I don't want anybody to think I'm old. but I grew up in operating systems development, went back and got an MBA so I could remove any source of knowledge that was important.
And you get to be in debt for the rest of your life, too.
Yeah, exactly. And then I was introduced to Agile. I too, worked at ThoughtWorks. I didn't know, Robert, that you were at ThoughtWorks. We're going to have to compare notes at some point. But I joined ThoughtWorks in 2005. I had never heard of Agile up until that point, but I started there as a developer after having gone through management roles. Went to ThoughtWorks as an Agile developer and then started doing more transformation work and consulting work with ThoughtWorks. Did some independent consulting and then just recently joined Leading Agile, and look forward to working with the smart people there.
All right. And just for the record, I come from a background of project management and dot-coms and web shops. And somewhere along the way, I was lucky enough to find my way into Agile. And now I'm a certified Scrum trainer, so that's pretty much... mostly what I do. I've done Agile coaching as well, but I am a project manager. It's burned into my soul, and I can no more make that go away than I can being an Irish Catholic from Philadelphia.
So what is your
PMP? Permanent dysfunction.
What is your PMP license number?
It's six digits, and I think it starts with a two. So it was 2002 when I got it, so I wasn't that early on. But on to our questions. So Justin was our first question, and so... I'm going to play the question now, and after we play the question, each of you guys will respond, and I'll kick in as well. I can probably offer a little context as well.
My name is Justin. My question is, within Scrum or the Safe Agile framework, how do you deal with teams that are not cross-functional, and how do you scale that up at an enterprise level?
All right, so there's Justin's question. So do you guys have any... suggestions or tips or questions, because I spent 2 days with a guy. I can probably offer some context if you have any questions about what he was asking about.
I'll get on my soapbox about continuums. There's rarely extremes. Nobody's agile or not agile. And similarly, there are usually not a non-cross-functional team and a cross-functional team. There's usually a continuum of a degree of cross-functionality within a team. So it really depends on the scenario that Justin is dealing with, in the sense of, you know, there are some organizations I've worked with where the database analysts come from a pooled resource. And so there's no database analyst on the team, and because of the rules, the database analyst is the only person who's allowed to make schema changes in the database. So that's not cross-functional in terms of the team, but you have to deal with, you know, sort of contract negotiation and that sort of thing with your database analyst who's part of a pooled resource. if you're talking about the extreme of non-cross-functional teams where your analysts sit in one corner and your developers sit in another corner and QA sits in another corner, that's from an Agile perspective, to me, that's not scalable. It's not even functional on a small scale. So part of the conversation I think that's necessary in an environment like that is to build the cross-functional teams and to rearrange the teams so that you have representation of those different roles on the teams.
Okay. Yeah, I think what he was talking about was a situation where it's like the Justice League. Like you've got the Flash and Green Lantern and Batman and Aquaman, and Aquaman's the only one who's allowed to talk to the fish and the only one who can talk to the fish. And nobody else can do that, and nobody else is going to develop that ability or wants to.
So yeah, I think, you know, not wanting to develop an ability, I think, is, in my mind, it's kind of anti-agile. You're supposed to really be moving along with everyone. Everybody's supposed to be helping everybody. At the end of the day, you really want to try to remove these impediments. So if within your team you've got folks who are just unwilling to change, then we have to look at why. Unwilling to learn, we have to look at why. I like Adrian's response about, look, you got to, you know, maybe rebuild the teams, reorganize the teams, yeah, in a certain way. I think the other point I wanted to make here is, and maybe it's not necessarily what he meant when he asked about, you know, within Scrum or SAFe. The cross-functional concept is not necessarily a workflow or methodology concept. It's part of the principles of Agile. Right. So if you look at SAFe, it's got to follow the principles of Agile, and Scrum will follow some of the principles of Agile. Right. And so think about the principles and how you're going to achieve the principles as a group. And that is where the cross-functional team comes from.
Yeah, I guess for me, I felt a little bit like part of the problem is maybe not so much the team members, but the Scrum Master. At least I would like them to come out of the class that I'm teaching thinking that it's the Scrum Master's job to create a culture where they see themselves as not a bunch of I's, but as a we, and that we fails or succeeds together. So it's just like working in a restaurant. You got time to lean, you got time to clean. Like, everybody should always be helping everybody.
And that's right. And I think with many of the transformations that we work on, it's not uncommon for us to find teams at first that are not cross-functional. And even when you reorganize a team, you'll find a lot of resistance to trying to help each other. But after a while, when teams get together and they start working together as a team, like you said, it's no longer the I, it's the we, you get towards the end of a sprint, then it really doesn't matter whether somebody is a QA or not, right? So you'll see the devs jump in and completely try to help QA.
Well, hopefully.
You'll see the devs try to help the a database analyst that might be stuck in trying to understand why something is not working effectively, for example, right? You'll see it happen over time. You can't coach culture, but you can encourage it through the right methodology and the right principles behind it.
Now, what if you've got, Adrian, I'll put this one to you first. What if you've got to convince management to reform these teams or to let you reform these teams? Is there a certain way to make that argument?
There is, and it requires, it's not an argument per se, but it's there's a lot of work that needs to be done potentially to educate management about, you know, what we're trying to accomplish in an agile environment. So it's building the understanding of why it's important to have a cross-functional team, why it's important to have fast feedback. So the QA is sitting next to the developer, and the QA says, "Hey, there's a bug here," and it can fix it right away. Versus in environments that I've seen in the past where development hands off to QA. Or development hands off to QA, which is in, 8 time zones away, and you don't get feedback until the next day. Building that cross-functional team so that you have representation allows for fast feedback. But you have to get management on board with understanding the whys of a cross-functional team. Why is it important? Not just saying, well, you need to reorganize because I said so or because Agile says so. It's about building the business case for why it's effective.
Cool. All right. Thanks. Did you guys want to try another question?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Hi, this is Anand. This is regarding the, scaling the Scrum. I have a situation where, we're building a migration project that will have 3 lines of business, and may contain like 100 to 150 people. Help needed, in building the Scrum teams.
All right, so Robert, do you have any suggestions? I mean, this is sort of a big, or do you have questions about anything that he said? Is there context that you need?
Yeah, so the question wasn't totally clear, but for the sake of discussion, I think we'll assume that when he meant by migration of projects is moving platforms or moving from one, let's say, one programming language to another or something like that, right? So we'll go with that assumption. Is that fair?
Sure.
All right. So to tackle this is a really, really big question, right? I mean, it's essentially asking how do I manage three business lanes of 150 people, 100 to 150 people, trying to work on migrating software, but because you also have to maintain it at the same time, you probably can't kill it, right? And chances are there are a ton of dependencies in between. Right. So if you're trying to move software from, what did we say, like .NET to Java, right? The dependency is not only within the code that exists, so you assume that the .NET code exists, but going over to Java and trying to replicate everything over, it's kind of troublesome, right? Because you don't really understand what you might miss or what you might not miss. Not everyone can see the whole depth of the software when it's that complex and you're trying to get out of it. My approach generally is to say, okay, let's stop back. Let's look at what we have at a base, right? Let's try to figure out at a high level. So what we might call that a portfolio level. What are the things that we still want to achieve within this migration? What are the software features that still want to support? And what are the first thing we need to work on? Break that down so that we can understand, okay, what does the scope of this thing look like? It's probably going to be pretty big. And how much work can we do in the next 3 months to make sure that we're taking step-by-step incremental releases to get there? Now, as you're trying to take a look at that work, I love to try to start getting into things like user journeys, for example. How is the user using the software? We have that knowledge, right? So if you've already got that piece of software that's running and you're going to transfer it to a new platform, well, you already know how the user is going to use it. So inform that, write the stories around that, and then try to cut the stories, slice them up in a way that allows you to build up these journeys in a way that everybody can start testing the new code under that new platform with the features going end to end. At least that's the first thing. Now, how do you take all that and organize it around the Java teams? Well, then you would take all these journeys and you could take the work of these user stories within those journeys and assign them to teams. And then you'll figure out how many teams you need in order to scale it up. At least at a high level, that's how I'm thinking.
Cool. Adrian, what about you?
That's funny. I once trained and coached a team that was went from zero agile knowledge to probably 20% agile knowledge in the 5 months I spent with them. It was a migration project. It wasn't a migration of software. It was migration of an ERP system or a migration of multiple ERP systems into a consolidated version with about 100 plus people. So it was about the same size, same scale as we're talking about. And it was an ERP consolidation project, so it was kind of a weird beast to be applying Agile to because you have to do a lot of underlying architectural work, which is sort of we try and shy away from in Agile software development. We let the architecture evolve, but if you're consolidating ERP packages into one, you need to define the structure so that you can map the existing ERP systems into the new one. So I think there are some basic tenets of how to form teams. And again, we don't know the specific kind of migration this questioner is asking about. But the basic tenets are cross-functional and make sure that the teams have an opportunity to go through the forming, storming, norming, performing. Don't form teams around periodic efforts and then disband them and reform. Try and form stable teams that you feed work into and then vary the work as necessary. A lot of people say 7 ± 2 as the optimal team size. If you have 150 people, that's at least 15 teams roughly, depending on how you chunk it out. I'm not a big fan of the 7 ± 2. I've had teams of up to 60. don't try this at home.
So that's kind of a big deal. You're talking about 60 people. That would go completely against what a lot of people would say. How do you make that work?
There are mechanisms that we introduced to mitigate the impact. The stand-ups were still less than 15 minutes with 60 people, if you can believe that. We were doing pair programming, so half of the developers were saying ditto to what their pair said for what they did yesterday. And then one of the things that I've done on projects as well is to have a secondary stand-up where the functional folks would get together and talk about the things that were very specific to their functional area. So developers would have a secondary stand-up where they get into the nitty-gritty of, you know, I've been trying to use this library and it's not working for me. Can somebody help me? That sort of thing.
Okay.
Stuff that the business analysts and the product owners and everybody else would just, you know, their eyes would glaze over.
Yeah.
And similarly for testers and for business analysts, they would have their own stand-ups where they talk about, you know, the stuff that's very specific to their roles. So the general stand-up was just for things that were relevant to everybody, and then the functional specific stand-ups were more targeted.
Cool. Okay. So can I ask you guys one additional question?
Sure.
So this is from I'm the one asking now, because this comes up in class all the time, and I'm curious to hear how each of you responds to this. When I get somebody who is asking about the architect wants to do all the work up front, has been always used to be doing all the work up front, is used to having this position of authority and oversight and control. How do you guys talk people down off that ledge when it comes to having self-organizing teams that are empowered to make their own decisions, assuming that the architect is not part of the team or not a regular part of the team?
Wow.
All right, Adrian.
I'm glad I'm asking this question.
No, it's a great question.
Now I don't feel so alone with my perplexity of how to explain this.
I remember going to a Scrum meetup, I think, in Atlanta one time years ago, and somebody was talking. They did two meetups in a row where somebody talked about doing conversion to Agile organizational wide versus, and the next time it was doing it more organically, like one team and then two teams and that sort of thing. And I think it was the organization that went whole hog on Agile and just converted everybody like with the, you know, drop of a pin, but they said we only lost three people quit when we did that. And you know, he seemed to be surprised about the low amount of the few number of people that left. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, tell me a little bit more about, you know, the three people that left. Why did they leave? And the guy said, well, those were the architects. and I thought that was very telling, because it's sort of like when you go from a organization or from a country has a dictatorship. The dictator has all the control, and you say, well, we're going to do democracy now. And the dictator says, well, what do I do? And you say, well, you know, you can vote too. The dictator loses a lot of their power in the conversion, to a democracy. Similarly with converting to Agile.
Yeah,
I've also been in an environment where there were a set of architects. There were multiple Scrum teams, probably eight or so. It was a large financial services firm, and we were reorganizing all the teams to make them more cross-functional and to have for a lot of other reasons. And I was proposing that we spread the architects across the teams. And this one architect, I met with him and somebody else from the organization, one of the managers. And he says, well, no, I think we should have an architecture team. We should just have, you know, a Scrum team that's just made up of the architects. And I said, well, what are you guys going to do? He says, well, we'll just architect. And I said, well, you know, that part of the problem with that is it gives sort of an ivory tower notion about architecture that I don't think is healthy for the organization. And his response, and I'll never forget it, was, well, sometimes ivory towers are good.
Wow.
And I just had nothing to say to that.
Yeah.
Ivory towers are never good. You know,
but it's easy to bag on the architects for this. I mean, I want to make fun of them too, but at the same time, this is their thing, you know? Yeah. And we've taken it away. We said, yeah, you know what? You used to be important, but now why don't you go clean the toilets like everybody else?
Yeah. So, you know, I could say a couple things, you know, on top of that, I think I would add is, first of all, yeah, I mean, I know we bag on the architects, but when you're going through an agile transformation, a lot of people's jobs are changing a lot, right? So project managers, I mean, they don't know what to do. They should suck it up.
They should all suck it up.
Yeah, right? They
should My people should suck it up.
You know, having been an architect before, so, you know, a couple things about that. One, I think that when you think about how Leading Agile approaches the transformation with the portfolio, the product, you know, product owner teams and the delivery teams, for us, the architect lives at that product team, right?
Okay.
So the architect would have a little bit of an opportunity to have to look ahead, because one of the goals we want to have is to have all these user stories written way ahead of the team, so that, you know, they have enough of a runway so that, yeah, you know, they'll never burn through your story and stories, and they're just staring at the wall. So in a way, that allows the architect to look forward and participate in trying to build these stories, these features, these epics, and trying to understand what they need to do. I think to some degree, you need a little bit of architecture. You need a little bit of an idea of what you're going to do, especially when you're talking about agile at scale. If you're talking about agile at a really small, you know, smaller size teams, maybe you don't. Maybe you can just build it as you go, try to figure out and iterate over that. I think the other part for me that usually encourages the architect to change their way of thinking and to think in small increments like everybody else, because I don't think there's anything wrong with that, is to look at how you measure a person's performance, right? So many people, we go into companies and suddenly they're, you know, you look at their performance, you know, metrics, and they say, oh, you know, you have to produce $2,000 a month and whatever, blah, 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 so that you can get a bonus at the end of the year. Well, for architects or even for developers, right? So we look at teams and we say, you know, you guys, we want you to have a stable velocity. If you tell me your velocity is 20 and you do it consistently, great for you, here's your bonus. But for an architect, usually we don't have that. So why not have a way to say, look, if you can show me how you're building this architecture in slices, in small slices, and moving along with the team without spending hours on end trying to look 2 years ahead for things that we're not going to do.
It sounds impossible.
It absolutely is possible, because you would have a review. I think it would be absolutely possible.
Okay.
Because if an architect is going to sit there and just write stuff over and over again and walk into your office and say, here's what my architecture looks like.
They're like project managers creating plans.
Yeah, exactly. So, but we're able to do that to a project manager, right? So we're able to move a project manager to a new role to say, hey, you know, stop the command and control. Here's how you want to do your job a little bit differently. You can still have the tools that you need to tell you that you're moving forward and doing the right thing. So why not do the same thing with the architect?
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying it sounds really hard. I mean, I know how hard it is for project managers, and we're used to being kicked in the head all day long. I don't think the architects are quite used to that.
Well, but David, you know, I mean, agile transformation and changing the way that you work, changing the way that you talk, and eventually through this process, changing your culture is hard to begin with.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And just because something is hard doesn't mean we shouldn't try to do it.
So back to those three guys, Adrian, that bailed. That doesn't sound, I mean, that was probably the smartest thing they could have done. Right? If they want their tower. That's okay.
Those are two different environments. The Ivory Tower was probably five architects, but the three that left was an anecdote from somebody else.
Okay. Sorry.
But I mean,
if I'm the architect, I like all that. I like the fancy nice
things. Absolutely. Stop putting on my red carpet, and I'll go somewhere else where they do put out a red carpet.
Yeah.
But you know, something, Robert, you said, which resonated with me, was you use the term architect and architecture intermittently in what we were saying. And it reminded me of this quote. I think I always forget who it is. I think it was Eisenhower said, plans are
useless.
Useless, and planning is indispensable.
Yep.
Well, I think it's the same thing with architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Architects are useless. Architecture is indispensable.
Oh, wow.
So if you have somebody whose sole job is being an architect and, you know, being in that ivory tower, then they're not useless. But, you know, it's at some point you lose your
I think you have to be willing to admit, and it's the same thing with a project manager. Any project manager who creates a project plan should be willing to have that thing come out and say, this is wrong, and give it to somebody. Say, this is the only thing that's not going to happen. If the architect is figuring everything out, it's great that they're thinking through it, right? But to think that that's exactly what we're going to do.
Right. Well, in the time that it took the project manager to print the thing.
You could have made something.
Walk over there. Yeah. It's out of date.
Yes.
Right.
So, it's the same thing with architect. Architecture is a responsibility of the team. It's not the responsibility of an individual on a team, in my estimation.
Cool. All right, guys, thank you very much for doing this.
Pleasure.
You're welcome. My pleasure. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks. So hopefully we'll do more. If anybody who's listening, if you've got questions you want answered by the coaches, just send them to me, and I will make sure we get somebody signed up for them. So thanks.
How would they send them to you?
Oh, well, I'll actually have in the show notes, thank you, my email address, and they'll be able to do that.
All right.
So that'll be right there in the bottom of the podcast. But it's dave.pryor@leadingagile.com.
Awesome.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Take care.
Thank you. Take care.